I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Most people's knowledge of Chase County, Kansas is limited to the 15 or so minutes they spend driving through it on I-35, where they pass the bizarre cattle crossing and the Matfield Green rest area at 75 miles an hour. William Least Heatmood is not one of those people. He spent 7 years walking through and writing about the place for his book, Prairie Earth. On its release, the book spent nearly 3 months on the New York Times bestseller list. Heat Moon will join us today to talk about the book 20 years after its release and about some of the characters he met in the process. And later in the program, Brian McTavish is back with the latest installment of the Weekend To-Do List. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 20 years ago this year, William Least Heat Moon of Missouri came out with a book about Kansas. Heat Moon's Prairie Earth takes a very deep look at the flora and fauna, people and places of Chase County, Kansas, who live amidst this continent's last remaining great expanse of tall grass prairie. In my estimation, it's simply an amazing book, once described as the Walden of our time. William Trogdon, who writes under the name of William Least Heat Moon, is an American travel writer of English, Irish, and Osage Nation ancestry. He's the author of Blue Highways and a best-selling trilogy of U.S. travel writing, Prairie Earth, River Horse, and Roads to Quaz. His pen name comes from his father, saying, "I call myself Heat Moon. Your elder brother is Little Heat Moon. You, coming last, therefore, are least." Best of all, Bill is a native of Kansas City, and he joins us this morning from KBIA in Columbia. And Bill, good morning. So good to have you here today.
Hello, Steve.
Well, let's begin, Bill, with the place itself. There are settings in Chase County where you can stand and look 360 degrees and see nothing but prairie and not a single tree. I wonder if you still think about times and places where you were in spots like that.
I think once the prairie enters your vision, and once it enters your soul and heart, if I may say that, it's something that never leaves. And even today, when I get into forest, there's a wonderful feeling about it. But after a while, I begin to feel confined. I can see that prairie when the horizon begins to shut down, even today.
Describe that prairie for us. When you think about it today, Bill, what goes through your mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind now that you asked the question is the openness of it. The space, and you've already mentioned the sky. Certainly those are physically, visually the dominant things that happen. But even more, I remember now the fine times that I had there, being, according to the people after I'd been working there. It took 7 years of reporting out there to put the book together. And I was, they considered me, in the words of one of the ranchers, half a bubble off plum because of what I was doing.
I have that phrase in my notes here somewhere, actually, Bill.
We can use that often today. But the people were so open, like the sky, they were so open. When I would ask a question, I don't remember even once somebody trying to dodge the question. When the question dealt with delicate topics, race, or environmental topics, a word that at that time was pretty much poison out there, they faced up to it. So I never felt I was being manipulated by the people. And that isn't always the case when a reporter goes into strange country, especially if he's an outsider.
You know, what absolutely fascinated me about this book, among so many things, was your decision to do it to begin with, Bill. I mean, as you have said yourself, there were no obvious storylines here. There were hardly any people, for that matter, about 4 per square mile, no obvious material for a writer, and yet that's exactly what you said you wanted. Why?
Well, I wanted to eliminate some of the confusion and the congestion and the dross around contemporary life, to try to look at things more clearly. And because of the wonderful clarity that can come to a traveler or a resident in the great Tallgrass Prairie, I thought things may show up better out here than they would, say, where I live now in Columbia, or even in Kansas City, which is on the edge of the Great Prairie, but no longer do you really realize that.
But as a guy who sort of writes myself for a newspaper, nothing like what you took on with this book, boy, you were really biting off a big chunk of the apple here, because walking into a place where there's no obvious storyline, I'm thinking, man, that takes some guts, Bill.
Well, I must say that Blue Highways, which came before Prairie Earth, made it possible for me to take on about any topic there for a while. The publisher was willing to listen to anything I wanted to do.
Because Blue Highways was so successful.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
But when I mentioned to them I'm going to write a book about Kansas, I'm not sure that their hats were in the air over that topic. These were all Easterners primarily, and they have a notion in their mind of what Kansas looks like, as does most of the nation outside of the people who live in the Great Plains. And I thought that's really what I want. I want to take on a place that is misperceived by most of the nation, underperceived, non-perceived, whatever it might be. I want to work against stereotype. So in that way, Kansas seemed like a good topic. But once the book came out, then we had to face the problem of attempting to sell a book to the American public about Kansas. As one woman told me, she said, "I know two things about Kansas. It takes two pages in the road atlas, and it's flat." I said, "Well, you got the two pages right, but the rest of it doesn't work so well." I said, "If you don't believe me about the flatness, get on a bike or on your feet and walk across the state, and you'll know it's not flat." And that's particularly true of the Flint Hills, where Chase County is.
Well, despite the fact it was about Kansas and it's flat and all of that stuff, you managed to hang around the New York Times bestseller list for a while. Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I thought it was going to be a tough book to move, and now that thanks to you, we're talking about the 20th anniversary coming up, the book has never been out of print. And although it was well-reviewed when it came out, there were some people who disliked the book very much. In fact, it seems to me now, looking back, that readers of Prairie Earth either hate it or they love it. There's
you
no
know,
in-between ground on it.
I think that's absolutely right, because I'm one of those readers who it took me 30, 40 pages, and then I was in deep. I just couldn't let go of it. And I could see how some folks would think, where are we going here? You know, this is, you know, it is a tough sell, I think.
It is, and I always believed that if I could get the reader past the first, you say about 30 pages, somewhere around, if I could get the reader past that, I thought that I could keep readers going. But I knew those early pages were going to be tricky, and I made it more difficult by putting some things in there. I don't want to say deliberately, but consciously, because I thought they needed to be there to tell the story. Preeminently, I'm speaking of the quote, all those quotations that begin each unit. I call them the commonplace books.
Yes.
We thought at one time before the book came out of putting a little preface in there that would suggest to the reader the way that I intended the commonplace books to be read, you know, a few at a time, then go into the main text, and then come back and read a few more. But my great editor, Jack Lezebnik, said, you know, Herman Melville does not tell readers how to read Moby Dick, mm-hmm. and certainly it presents some of these same problems. I'm not going to put myself in the league with Moby Dick, but we decided that's right. The readers must find their own way. And for 20 years, and now I repeat myself, for 20 years, you know, it's been working, to my great surprise.
You know, one of those quotes that – there are so many of those quotes that were just so interesting to me, and I just would, you know, wonder how you came across so many of them. But one of them, and I was looking for it last night, has stuck with me to this day. And it talked about, and I forget even who said it, but the importance that should be placed for each person to develop a connection with a specific plot of land or a certain place, and to walk that land and get to know it. And there's a place in my life that sort of hits that mark, and I'm just was so struck by that. I thought, what a perceptive thing to say, and it really resonated with me as clearly as it did.
Steve, I'm glad to hear you say that, because if there's one word that I think connects my five books, it is connections.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that one of the things that I'm most concerned about with the young, that I'm 72, so that includes a lot of the population now younger than I am. I think that in too many ways, we as Americans, and maybe across the globe, I'm not so sure about that, but maybe so, we as Americans are losing or weakening our connections with where we come from. And first of all, we come from the land. I mean, physically, we sit here. We are made of the same substance as the earth. And when we begin to lose those connections, I think that we lose a base for moral and ethical values, among other things.
Hmm. We're visiting with a great writer, William Least Heapmoon of Columbia, Missouri. We're talking about his book 20 years ago that came out, Prairie Earth, about Chase County, Kansas. Well, we've talked a couple times here, Bill, that this book is 20 years old, and you're still with us, which strikes me as something special because you once said that writing Prairie Earth almost did you in.
Oh, my heavens. It was an 8-year project. I took 1 year off to build a house out in the woods. But otherwise, for those 7 years, I was working on it. And with no assurance that this book would be readable or published. I knew that they were going to have to pay me some money, as agreed upon, to begin the book. But still, to see the book do what I wanted to do, it was a real gamble. And to hang on for 7 years against that was, I wouldn't want to do it again, let me put it that way.
And one thing that struck me, I think you wrote early in the book, I'm just recalling it from reading it about a year ago, but you talked early in the book about your struggles with trying to figure out how to organize something that became this massive, this much of an in-depth look at one place, you know, Chase County, Kansas. What did you finally settle on to help you organize this book, and how did that idea come to you?
That was the key problem. After about six years, I had two big cartons full of papers and material about Chase County. I'm talking about several thousand sheets of paper and notes and tape recordings. And how does this fit together? How can I do this? And I just couldn't come up with the idea. I usually have this trouble in writing, finding the structure of a book. That's the hardest thing for me. And I was at the point of near despair when one afternoon I had the USGS survey maps, the 7.5-minute series. For people who hike and know those maps, they're wonderful maps. They're about 2 feet by 3 feet each. It took 25 of them on the floor of my study to cover all of Chase County. And so, you know, I was having to walk around the map to read it. I realized that the outside layer of maps, outside border of maps, was 13, and when I removed, that was just a tiny part of the county. When I removed those, I had the heart of the county, well, more than that, 12 maps. And I was looking at the 12 maps, and I started thinking, 12, that's a significant number in for writers. Epics, classic epics, traditionally are broken into 12. So immediately I started thinking 12, and I separated those 12 maps, and it formed a kind of grid. Huh. And anybody who has a copy of the book can see that grid of 12 rectangles through the book and on the cover. It was those 12 rectangles that I thought, ah, I was walking back and forth, as I mentioned, to read in the map, and it dawned on me, I'm going to go back again to the county after 7 years, 6 years it was, and start walking those 12 rectangles and using that as a way to assemble the pieces. In other words, to stitch things together, to mix my metaphor here, by walking by using feet to stitch this together.
And when you figured that out, the grid idea, did the light bulb sort of go off and you thought, this is it, this is the path forward?
Yes, I think so. I felt reasonably confident then. I wasn't sure still, you know, what kind of reception the book would get, but I knew then, almost knew, I believed then that I could hook this material together. There were still other things to solve, but that was the essential thing. And from that point on, I wrote the book rather quickly, given that it's over 600 pages long.
622, Bill.
Thank you.
Well,
I don't want to do that.
I'm just wondering how much pressure there was on you as a writer after 6 years to have that much information and still to be standing there in your study and looking in the mirror each morning as you shave thinking, I'm not really sure how I'm going to put this beast together.
I use all sorts of tricks when I'm writing to keep myself going because I'm never that confident that what I'm saying is going to be of interest to anybody. So I pretend that I have a reader there and that this reader is excited about what's going on. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But a bad thing happened just as I was getting toward the finishing point. I had two editors, one in Boston who worked for the publisher and one here in Columbia, my great friend Jack Lezebnik, whom I just mentioned. The editor in Boston decided he got angry with me about my refusal to write a blurb for a book that he was doing that I thought was a schlock. And he took his anger out by jumping on the manuscript of Prairie Earth, which he had, it wasn't the finished draft, but it was close. And he went through the manuscript and just took it apart and left me with what I thought was pieces. And I thought, okay, I don't think I can go on. I was into it by 7 years by that point. I think I'm through. I went outside the house and I walked around in a circle I have out there for about 25 minutes, just walking as fast as I could in a circle. And I decided I've got to go turn to my other editor, my great friend. So I gave the manuscript the next morning to Jack, who read the book, the whole book, the manuscript form, in 2 days, and called me at 10 o'clock a couple of days later, and he said, "It's a great book." Well,
wow.
I'm not going to put that forth coming from me, but it was enough to give me the belief that I could continue. And so I got up off the floor and finished the book. And the editor in Boston later rescinded some of his comments, but he almost killed Prairie Earth. It almost died.
Man, that's a story. Again, our guest, William Least, Heat Moon. His book, Prairie Earth, was published 20 years ago this year. It's that in-depth look at Chase County, Kansas. If you've read the book and want to join our conversation, perhaps you have a question for Bill, our number, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Bill, do you still go back to Chase County very often?
I do. I was out there a year ago last July. We had a celebration of events out there. It was the second hottest day in Kansas that July, and almost 1,000 people showed up for the release of a film called Return to Prairie Earth, done by John O'Hare of Wichita, or formerly Wichita. It's a lovely film that he made about the county. Oh, you have? Oh, good.
Yeah.
So we were really that was the release of the film. And I thought we'd get 25 people coming out. We were sitting out in the pasture to do all of this. And as I say, we had almost 1,000 people there. And that is just staggering, given that here's a book about Kansas, which, as we said earlier, you know, America thinks it knows Kansas, but it doesn't. But they've given it a chance, given the state a chance and the book, too, I guess.
Hey, how did the folks down there react to your book?
Oh, it was a mixture of responses. Those whom I talked to, for the most part, I think were satisfied with it. But they knew what was going to happen in their section of the book before it came out, because when I write, I always go to the people I've been interviewing, and let them read what I'm going to publish. So they have a chance to make any corrections that they need. But then the ones whom I didn't talk to, they were upset with me because even though I talked to 10% of the population in the county, if they missed it, he didn't talk to me, so the book is short, this or that.
Can you buy the book down in Chase County?
Well, last July you could, yes, indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a man in the book named Slim Pinkston, the county's most famous cowboy, and a character shaped by the bovine nature of the animals he spends his days with. Tell us about Slim Pinkston.
Well, that's a great follow-up question, and I want the listeners to know we didn't set this up. His response, I'm alluding to your last question, his response when the book came out. Now, I had gone down to his house, interviewed him. We sat there at his kitchen table, had my tape recorder going, taking notes. He got to see what I was going to say. But then when the book came out, he was upset. And my great friend and leader, really, in the county, my conductor there, Whit Lockridge, when I came to town to release the book in October of 91, I said, "Well, I'm going to go down and say hello to Whit, to Slim." And Whit said, "Oh, my God, no, don't go down there." I said, "Why? What is it?" He said, "Oh, Slim's mad at you." "Why?" He said, I don't know, but stay away." So Slim, he didn't show up for the release of the book. All the other people who appear at length in the book were there in front of the courthouse on Broadway in Cottonwood Falls. Mm-hmm. But Slim didn't show up, and he died not too long after that. So to this day, I don't know quite what it was he was upset with me about.
Mm.
But he was indeed a character, and he was fun to write about, as I think maybe the first paragraphs of that chapter on Slim Pinkston show. I hope they do.
Well, tell us about him. Just describe him for us a little bit.
Well, I think I say in the book, I'm trying to remember now my prose from 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I think
right.
I say he's. You can probably help me more on this, Steve, than I can. He's about as wide as he is tall.
Mm-hmm.
He was another man who he pulled no punches. He told it as it was, or as he saw it. And as long as we were talking there, man to man, he was a generous soul. He was a delight to be with, and that's why I wanted to go down and say hello to him.
Well, all these questions, as I was preparing my show last night, I was sitting there thinking, I hope Bill can remember some of these folks from 20 years ago. I'm not sure I could if you were asking me about a story I wrote 20 years ago. So I know I'm reaching a little bit here. There was also a chapter that just fascinated me. You spent a day sort of sitting covertly in the back of your van, sort of chronicling the traffic along the main drag in Chase County and Cottonwood Falls there, just to get
Cedar Point,
okay.
Yeah,
and just talking about, you know, there weren't a whole lot of people moving around, and you sat there all day and sort of chronicled who walked by. Why did you do that?
It struck me as one way of coming to know a place, mm-hmm. just to be like a post with ears and eyes, and stay in one position and let the, in this case, Cedar Point, sometimes called out there Cedar Pointless because it's almost gone now, to watch the activity such as it was in Cedar Point go by. It would have been too much to do, say, in Cottonwood Falls, which has a population, I believe, of about 900 people. Cedar Point at that time, I'm making guess now, drawing on bad memory, but I would say maybe it had 50 people.
Yeah.
So it was an easier thing to do, and that's one of the reasons I chose it. But it's a town that some people would see as a dying town. So I wanted to watch, is this a death that I'm watching, or is there something else going on here? I had a little espresso maker with me, and I sat here to keep awake, drinking a few cups of espresso, and just watching through the windows of the van. The van, by the way, the same one that I used in the Blue Highways trip in 1978.
A lot of people around here, Bill, will be familiar with the Chase County Courthouse that you just mentioned. I mean, you explored that building in the book all the way from its bell tower up on top all the way down to the jail in the basement. What strikes you about that building all these years later? What interested you so much about it?
Well, it's the either now the first or the second oldest courthouse in Kansas still in continuous use, so it has that distinction. But it's a good-looking building, and it's so well exposed. It does not sit well. It is in a square, but not the typical kind of square that you see throughout the Middle West. It really is sort of at the head of Broadway, a very broad, in this case, a very broad street. So it looks like a throne, and if you imagine the red bricks of Broadway being a red carpet, it's like you're walking up to the emperor as you go toward this building. Its exposure is just marvelous. And it comes right from the county. The stones that it's built of, this huge blocks of limestone, come from only about a quarter mile away. And I'm not sure that there are too many courthouses in the country that can make that statement, that we almost pulled the rock out of the ground and built a courthouse in the hole.
You found some pretty cool stuff down in the jail, you know, notes from prisoners and evidence that they had been there. What do you recall from the jail?
Oh, I can't remember. Things were scratched on the steel walls. And Steve, I can't remember a single one now. Have you got the book there? You could maybe remind me.
I don't have it
one.
Right here. No, I just was so struck that. But my point is, you really delve down so deeply into, you know, what everything was about. And it was just, it's such an interesting approach to things. And it just strikes me, too, Bill, as such a solitary kind of pursuit, and I just wonder how you managed that over all those years, and still in the back of your mind wondering if the book would work or not, and being so alone as much of the time as you were.
Well, I would typically go out to, I was living in Columbia then, and I would go out to Chase County every so often, and I would stay a week. I was never there more than about 3 weeks at a time, mm-hmm. then come back home. So I wasn't quite as cut off as, say, as I was on the Blue Highway trip, which was 3 months of being alone, and where desolation there was a real threat to end the trip. But with working with Chase County, and especially as the more I was there, I got to know people. So I'd have dinner with them. We would hang out together, and it really was not a lonely experience. And when I was alone out in some broad piece of, as they call it, pasture of the prairie itself, That isolation felt good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with William Least Heap Moon about his book, Prairie Earth. 20 years ago, it was published. We'll talk about Larry Wagner, crippled by polio, who talks about his attempts to save the tall grass prairie, and Fidel Ybarra, who even to this day recalls all the spikes he ever drove on the railroad down there, and Linda Thurston, whose cafe went bust, and he's quoted her as saying, "We never did get the farmers to eat the alfalfa sprouts." So we'll talk about Linda Thurston as well. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Be sure to join us tomorrow as our political pundits will give you a preview of the Iowa caucuses and give us their predictions for the next Republican presidential nominee. Today we're visiting with William Least Heap Moon about his book, Prairie Earth, that came out 20 years ago. It chronicles the life and times of Chase County, Kansas. Just a very, very much of an in-depth look. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, and our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. We had a question here from one of our researchers here, Bill, from Danny Alexander, and she asked this. You know, some people might consider Prairie Earth a road novel along the lines of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and On the Road by Jack Kerouac. Writing like this by women, though, she says, seems hard to come by. Is there something inherently masculine about this kind of genre?
I have in my library at home 3,000 and some books that are about, they're travel books about travel in America, mm-hmm. only in America. That's not including Europe or any place else. Of those 3,000 and some books, less than 10% have been written by women.
Wow.
And I've said this a number of times as I've talked and written this and that through the years, that disproportionate percentage, I think, really needs to be rectified. And I do believe it's getting somewhat better. Since Blue Highways came out, and to be frank, it did a lot to open up travel as a genre in this country. There have been more books coming out by women, but still, the imbalance is really notable in this country. And given that women went west in just about the same numbers and came to this continent in the same numbers as men, we're all the descendants of travelers. So we need to hear from the distant side of our nation.
Why do you think that is?
Well, certainly part of it is just the general holding back of women and confining women to certain kinds of occupations, certain kinds mm-hmm. of duties in society and so on, a great deal of that. But then I must say that when you look at 19th century, especially 19th century British travelers and the books that they wrote, the percentage of women among those is considerably higher. So it's something that the British women over the last couple of centuries have outperformed us, and I don't like that. So I think that the question here is we need to encourage women to get out and hit the road. This may be a more dangerous country than certainly than England, but the places where these English traveling women were going were much less safe than what we find here in America. I mention that because so many times women say, "I'd like to write a book, I'd like to go on the road or get in the boat, whatever. But I'm just concerned about my safety." Some say, "Well, I'll take a dog. Maybe that'll help." But I think the nation, provided one uses one's head, common sense, I think the nation is not nearly as frightful and threatening as it might seem from listening to the news.
We have some interesting tweets coming in. Bill, my uncle and aunt got married at Chase County Courthouse. One listener writes, "Had to leave the motor running because the bride was underage." Frank from Lawrence writes this: "Years ago, I heard a story of a Kansas couple who vacationed in Vermont. They said they had a terrible time because their view was blocked by mountains and trees. I'm a native Kansan, but I later lived in Vermont 2 years as a graduate student, and I understood that sentiment." I get that completely, too. Bill writes this: "In his time spent in the Flint Hills, what conclusions does he make about the modern-day culture of the region? How does the unique beauty touch him, if at all?"
Well, I think we've talked some about the beauty, the openness of the prairie, I don't know that I can expand on that too much further with the time we have, other than to say that somebody who's thinking about visiting the Tallgrass Prairie, Chase County is the place to go. That's where the best remaining piece of Tallgrass Prairie is. The Kanza Prairie, a little farther north near Manhattan, has a nice section too, but it's not quite as expansive, I think, as you find in Chase County. I recommend that traveler go in October when those grasses start turning color, depending what, as with leaves, you know, up on the temperatures and rainfall, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Or the early spring, right after the burning. The burning takes place toward the end of March and maybe a little bit into early April. So sometime toward the end of April, when the grass starts coming up green, the color, the intense color of that green over the hills is just marvelous. So April, October, those are really the times, I think, to see the beauty of the Tallgrass Prairie.
Bill, how accessible is it just to go down there and walk the prairie? Can you just drive up and get out and start walking?
Well, I did that often, sometimes, probably frequently in trespass. People finally got to know me, and I think I was questioned about it just one time in 7 years. But it's easier now because of, and we should maybe talk about this, Steve, the establishment of the Tallgrass Prairie National Refuge there, mm-hmm. which was a big troublesome issue when I was writing the book. But it's now you can go to just off of Highway 50, take 50 right out of Kansas City and follow it into Chase County, stop just north of Strong City, and there's the park and the headquarters, and there's all kinds. I mean, you have, gosh, how many acres is it? Now, I can't cite the acreage, but it's quite large. And you'll have the Heritage Center there to explain to you beforehand. You go out so you'll know more of what you're seeing, and you can actually come across some bison now that are in the park that were not there when I was writing the book.
Lots of phone calls for William Lee's Heat Moon. Let's go to them now. Steve from Roland Park, good morning.
Oh, hi. I wanted to relate a couple of things. I read Prairie Earth about 10 years ago and got my daughter onto it. And my daughter was a college student at the time, and it led her to Wes Jackson, another Midwestern author. And I was able to influence her by getting her to read Richard Rhodes as well. And now she is involved in sustainable agriculture and grazing, and the book had a great influence on her. And I've bought copies and given to other people. And I also happened to run into Mr. Least Heat Moon. I don't know if he'll remember or not, at a Cracker Barrel restaurant on the interstate in Columbia, and I was quite chagrined to, and I was reading Prairie Earth at the time, and I was quite chagrined to run into him at the Cracker Barrel restaurant after following him and his writing about food over the years. It was a big kick. And River Horse meant a lot to me, too. It's gotten me on the rivers, and I really enjoyed your book, and especially your encounters with animals. I remember the little incident about the mouse that got in your car and drove you crazy one night.
I do recall our meeting at the Cracker Barrel because you were chagrined. I was chagrined about being caught in a chain restaurant. Here is the man who, throughout his books, is continually championing the Bert and Betty cafes and diners and fish parlors of the country, and I was caught red-handed in a Cracker Barrel. I don't go there anymore. Their political persuasion is different from mine, so I give my money to the local folks.
Steve, thank you.
Anyway, your books had a great impact. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Jim, Steve, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I just in light of what was that Steve just calling?
Yes.
What he said is that my great hope for Prairie Earth, and this goes back to an earlier question, one thing that kept me going is that I believed that if I could show people, not only in Kansas, but across America, that a place like Kansas, taken to be the definition of dullness, if I could show them that that was false, then they would realize that wherever they live, that their area, their land, is just as deep and interesting, and with the result that maybe they will connect with their place just as the people in Chase County try to connect with theirs.
You know, Steve mentioned the mouse. So does Jim, who sent us an email, Bill, saying, can Bill talk about the mouse up the pant leg? I thought it was a hilarious diversion from A Most Wonderful Journey. I love the book.
It wasn't up the pant leg. It was in the car with me. It ran. I was driving at night, the mouse ran across the dashboard, and I thought I was seeing things. then I imagined it going across the back of the seat and going down my shirt. I imagined that part of it. So when I got I was staying in Emporia at the time, just outside the county. When I got to Emporia, I went to a grocery and bought a mousetrap, and I thought, this isn't going to work. But I put one on the floor of the passenger side and one in the trunk. And the next morning, sure enough, there was a mouse in the trap. I had carried it from home. I've got a real mouse infestation in the garage at home, and I had carried that mouse with me. And I like to think that the little guy was up there in the dashboard taking a good look at the prairie, which he had never seen.
Priscilla from Hiawatha. Priscilla, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment to Mr. Lee Keaton that someone gave me your book, Prairie Earth, to read about 10 years ago. And the first couple of chapters were real work for me to read, but about by the third chapter, I was hooked. And one of the benefits of that book for me was it made me want to go and walk the county as you had walked it and to see those things from that perspective. And especially what struck me, and I can't remember quite how you said it, but you talked about how the Native Americans with the leaves of the cottonwood trees as they rustled, some significance. And ever since then, when I walk, and I'm walking among cottonwoods, I always think of those trees and hear the leaves rustling in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated how you opened my eyes and ears to see and hear differently. You know, so I thank you for that.
Priscilla, thank you very much for the call.
Yes, thank you, Priscilla. An editor in New York City, after the book came out, said to me, is the cottonwood a real tree? I said, oh, indeed it is, and it's a marvelous tree. Steve, if I could add one more thing, it's come up a couple of times here in our talk.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting through the first chapters or so of Prairie Earth is somewhat of a, it's not that much of a challenge, but it's not an immediate grabber. But I think that I have, except for Blue Highways, I think that that's something that runs through most of my books. My last book, Roads to Quaz, we had a big debate, the editor in New York and I, about which would go first, what I had as chapter one or what he, or chapter two. And he finally convinced me to reverse them. But the reversal means that the reader has to work just a little harder through the current chapter one of Roads to Quaz.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who has a Quaz handy or will look at one, maybe if I could say this now, a secret to all my fellow Kansas Cityans, start with chapter two. It's got more of a hook to it. Then you can go to one. I think we made a mistake in doing it. I fought it, but it's the only time I ever yielded on a major editorial decision on one I didn't agree with. I gave in on that, and I'm kind of sorry I did.
What's the next book, Bill?
The next book, which will be out next year, is called Here, There, Elsewhere. And I think it might be of interest to people in the Kansas City area. It has a story, a short story in this case, fiction, barely fiction, based upon my family, set in Kansas City. It has the Missouri River in Missouri and some in Kansas in there. It's got two pieces on Kansas. One of them is my recollections in the late 40s and early 50s of how people who came from out of state would pass through. I lived on the Missouri side, would pass through Kansas City, getting ready to cross Kansas on their way to Colorado. And in those days, without air conditioning and autos, you know, we did it at night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so people went through Kansas. They drove the 400 and some miles across the state, and they really didn't see what was there. So their wronged notions were not corrected. So there's a piece about it. It's called Crossing Kansas, primarily, in, as they say, in the 40s and 50s. There's another piece about Kansas as a part of the Great Plains.
Mm.
There are a number of connections, although in this new book, Here, There, Elsewhere, there are also stories about Italy and England, Scotland, Japan. It's a different thing from others that I've written. And once again, though, I must say, Steve, that first chapter may be a bit of a challenge to get through. So if anybody's listening who can remember this, when you see Here, There, Elsewhere next year, consider going to chapter two and then coming back to chapter one, which sets things up. But it's more of an essay than a story.
The great author William Lee Heatmoon is our guest. He's the author of Prairie Earth, which is our subject today, written and published 20 years ago this year. Mary Ann from Elton, Missouri. Mary Ann, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to call in. I grew up in Chase County, actually, just outside of Cedar Point, And I remember distinctly when the book came out, I think I was 11, and I remember my parents and grandparents getting their brand new copies. And I mean, from a kid's perspective, I was just like, why would anyone want to write a book? Like, this place is so boring. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's really cool now as an adult to just, you know that the place where I grew up and is so special to me, you know, is that noteworthy now, and I appreciate it a lot more now. But I just want to say I'm looking forward to reading the book now that I'm a little bit older.
Marianne, thank you for that. How old are you now, can I ask?
I'm 31 now.
31, yeah. You're definitely of age to read Prairie Earth, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I can handle it now.
Marianne's response was one that I heard frequently over the 7 years when I was doing my reporting in Chase County. Once people found out I was writing a book, I kept it hidden as long as I could, but finally the cat was out of the bag. Then they would say to me, why are you writing about us? Why would you do that? And they would name other counties around that they thought were more suitable for a book. And I believe, no, this is the one that I want. Now I think if you talk to people there about the book, they understand why they're important and significant. And the thing that's happened, and if the book has made a gift to the county people, I think it did help their self-esteem, in which they realize that, yes, this is a highly rural place, only 3,000 people thereabouts in the county, but it is significant for the way that they live, and when we share that way that they live, they themselves become important.
Do you think the county's been adequately protected, Bill, against satellite towers and wind turbines and everything else?
I'm dubious about that. I'm dubious about any kind of protections that we place in this country, because it seems so often that the moneyed corporate interests find ways of getting around the things that we set up to protect ourselves, whether it's banking laws or something else. And I know the wind turbine issue in the Flint Hills, but certainly in Chase County, is significant. I believe in wind turbines, but there are places where they should not be. And because of the uniqueness of the Flint Hills in Chase County, I think that is not a good place for them.
Hmm. Well, Bill, I sure enjoyed having you here today. What a monumental achievement. And, again, I just can't recommend Prairie Earth enough. I sure enjoyed having you here today.
Oh, Steve, I should say to your listeners that you were so dedicated in pursuing this interview. It took us months to bring this off, but this is one of the best interviews I've had, and it's been a long time since I've had a chance to talk at length about Prairie Earth. So,
well, that's great. I wanted to take you down to Chase County and do the interview down there, and next time you're heading through Kansas City and driving down that way, come get me, because I'd love to come down there with you.
Oh, absolutely. And if I might take 1 second to thank the people of Kansas City for starting this book off. It began moving in Kansas City, and the rest of the nation saw what was happening in Kansas City, and it then went on other places. But it was my good fellow former Kansas Cityans, now that I'm in Columbia, who launched it. So I want to thank all of you who helped there.
Well, Bill, it's been a pleasure. All the best to you.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You bet. That's William Least Heatmoon, author of Prairie Earth. Coming up, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list.
Oh. I know a place. Ain't nobody crying. Ain't nobody worried. No. Ain't no smiling faces. Mm-mm. No, no.
Man, that's music.
You are so there.
Oh, that's there. I am there.
You got up. Mavis. I got to tell the listeners, you got up out of that chair.
I was moving, wasn't I?
You were moving.
I like that.
You don't even charge extra for that, do you?
I should.
And maybe you will if it comes to it.
But you see that. Boy, that was something. She is something.
Mavis Staples. Let's say it again. Mavis Staples.
Yeah.
The rhythm and blues soul and gospel dynamo.
No kidding.
Tonight, 7:30.
Wow.
Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. She's been going there since 1950, when she became a member of the family singing group, the Staple Singers.
Wow.
And it took her 60 years to win her first Grammy, if you believe that.
Hmm.
She won Best Americana Album at this year's Grammy Awards. So that was produced by Jeff Tweedy of Wilco.
No kidding.
Who was just here last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's a really cool-sounding record. It's an interesting combination of
sounds. What's the record again?
It's called You Are Not Alone.
Wow.
And if Mavis is singing in the room, you are not alone, trust me.
Yeah.
Going back, the Staple Singers went from a pure gospel group. They were known as God's greatest hitmakers. I would not argue with that. To eventually, by the early to mid-70s, a hip-hop group, albeit with gospel roots.
Mm-hmm.
Their top 40 hits, the ones that come to mind, they're the first one we just heard there, I'll Take You There. They also did Let's Do It Again. She'll do that tonight at the Kaufman. And, you know, they had a big hit with Who Took the Mary Out of Christmas, certainly not Mavis Staples. And I think Mavis, it's that time of year, right?
Yeah.
I think she's going to sing that tonight. I'd sure like to think so. Interestingly enough, I can't verify this. I can verify.
Go ahead and say it anyway.
I can actually.
Put it out there.
There's so little certitude.
Yes.
But apparently, a few years ago on that NPR show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me,
yes,
which is very funny on the weekends.
Sure.
Saturday mornings,
I believe,
on KCOR FM.
Noon, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. In any event, she was a guest on that show. And apparently the words came out of her mouth that she had been very close to Bob Dylan. And that Bob Dylan had apparently asked her father for her hand in marriage.
No kidding.
I don't think
she did not know this.
Well, I did not know that either. I thought that was worth mentioning, even if it's a scandalous rumor removed by 40 years or so.
That's Mavis Staples tonight at 7:30 at the Kauffman Center. How about Kathy Griffin?
How about Kathy Griffin?
How about her?
That's one witty redhead, a real smart aleck, actually a reality TV show smart aleck. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, maybe we could just listen a little bit to her talking about her and her mom.
Let's.
I took my mom to a fancy resort. Here's what happened. Now, like I said, my mother thinks the prices are what they were in the Depression. So we're all sitting around, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm just being a good daughter. Let's cheer her up and stuff. So my mom opens the menu, and I hear her just making these weird sounds of discontent. Like that. So the waiter comes, and my mom is really rude to the waiter. And I'm like, I don't know what's up. So I hear my mother say, well, I guess I'll take the chicken sandwich. I go, Mom, what are you being so rude for? And she goes, $8.95 for one damn chicken sandwich. And then she turns to the waiter and uses like some old-time expression he couldn't possibly figure out. You got a lot of crust.
It's 8 p.m. Saturday at the Music Hall, right?
Yes, Kathy Griffin, most famous for hosting the reality TV show Kathy Griffin, My Life on the D-List, but probably, you know, that's got to be the best example of using self-effacement as a passport to true celebrity. Along the way, she's...
That's been my key, by the way.
Well, and it's the key of Steve, apparently.
Yes. just throwing that out.
Can I be in your song sometime?
Yes, you can.
Would that be okay? Okay.
Yes, yes.
What was I going to say before you took us there? You keep taking me there.
Yes.
Kathy Griffin, she has a very loyal audience among members of the LGBT community for her espousal of equal rights for all in society, regardless of sexual orientation. But my favorite Kathy Griffin is the one who co-starred... actually, she was the sidekick to Brooke Shields in the late 1990s show Suddenly Susan.
Wow.
Her character's name was Vicky Groner because she groaned. Very funny woman.
And speaking of humor, Cedric the Entertainer is going to be here, too.
He is. It's just a cavalcade of comedy this weekend.
No kidding.
Cedric the Entertainer, born Cedric Antonio Kyles, just in case you were wondering. Get this. Born in Jefferson City, Missouri.
Did not know that.
Raised in Caruthersville, Missouri.
Did not know that.
I'm here every week, but you knew that.
Yes, I
okay,
knew that.
Okay, great. I was just checking. I always like to lighten the mood. That's thus my presence here.
Yes.
But anyway, Cedric, he spent 5 or 6 years on the Steve Harvey Show. He was featured in the Spike Lee documentary, The Original Kings of Comedy.
Hey, we've got some Cedric the Entertainer here.
Let's hear some.
Bill Clinton is a cool dude. I met Clinton for real. I met him at Michael Jordan little golf tournament, you know, and I didn't know that you get to keep your Secret Service with you. Whenever you've been the president, it don't matter. Once you leave, you get to have Secret Service with you all the time. It's like a little pardon gift from the White House or something, you know. And I found out the hard way because I don't play golf that well, you know, so I hit my ball and, you know, it went all off in the trees and shit. I'm going over there to find my ball. Like 6 Secret Service jump out. I'm like, what's up, motherfucker? Yeah, like, be advised, we've got Cedric the Entertainer on the trees.
He is funny. He is gregarious. He will make you laugh doing his stand-up comedy thing at 7 p.m. Sunday at the Midland. by AMC.
And also the Kansas City Steampunk Circus Social 2. What is this? Social 2, a Clockwork Christmas Social. What is that?
Well, I'm going to tell you
a
now.
A benefit for harvesters.
It is a benefit for harvesters. It features steampunk-inspired apparel, contraptions, and entertainment at 8 p.m. Saturday, Davies Uptown Ramblers Club in Midtown. What is steampunk?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? I was asking you.
I
was really counting on this. I have no. I've done no research on this.
But we did. Steampunk, we're just throwing
it out. Real quick. I'm pulling both of your legs. Steampunk. It's this kind of marriage of 19th century Victorian what have you with sci-fi fantasy. It's crazy. It's fun. I think you'll even see a bit of its influence in the Sherlock Holmes movie coming out later this month.
Okay.
Met a girl, thought she was grand. Fell in love, found out firsthand. Went well for a week or two, then it all came unglued.
Who is that?
Puddle of Mud, the American rock band that is from, yes, I try to keep it local, Kansas City, Mo. They will rock and roll with other bands of a rock mind at 6:30 p.m. today. That's a tonight show. Also tonight, get your weekend started early at the Midland by AMC. New album. They cover Rolling Stones, Bad Company, Led Zeppelin, AC/DC. They're good.
You're good. That's Brian McTavish of KCConfidential.com.
Take me there, man.
I will. You bet. Be sure to join us tomorrow for a preview of the Iowa caucuses with our political pundits. We had help today from KCUR's Luke Martin, Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.